Oliver Kuttner joins me live in studio, celebrated Charlottesville developer, international entrepreneur, and winner of the Automotive X Prize. Oliver, thank you for coming in. I'm glad you're here.
Hello. It's nice to be here. So, you got me a little nervous with the pitchforks.
Oh, you don't like
I wasn't going to go that far.
About that.
Yeah, I wasn't going to go that far, but the underlying principle is correct.
Yeah. And,
to me, the Brexit is just another symptom of most people not seeing how they're going to have a better future, perhaps a lesser future. And one of the things that I learned in my journey with Edison too, where I got to meet a lot of high-level people in large companies, is how companies work. And how they really work is this. You have 10 people who have to make a decision. And there are always some that have a reason not to go in a direction. And there are some that are getting ready for retirement. There are some that have other agendas. And the result is that basically very little happens. So what has become very clear to me is that in large organizations, change is the enemy. And what's very interesting is a lot of large companies actually profile themselves as innovative or change embracing. While I meet many people inside the companies that are like, oh, we know how to do this better, we know how to do this, but we can never get there. We never get the assignment, we never get the clear shot.
And at the core, Oliver, that's one of the things you see with the EU, right?
Well, what has happened is we've gotten away from innovation. So we've gotten away from change. And really in large organizations, whether it's a corporation or it's a political system, you don't want to create change. You want to look like you do, but you don't. And when you try to preserve the status quo at all costs, while some people gnaw on trying to optimize profits just a little bit more without thinking long term, then you are essentially making the vast majority of people a little bit poorer while a few people get a check. And this is the foundation of the problem. And the result of this problem becomes people get frustrated and they don't know where to go. I personally believe that the success of Donald Trump and the success of Bernie Sanders is actually based on the same symptom. And the success of the Brexit is based on the same symptom. And the result is that if this keeps moving, it's a very volatile, bad situation in a world in which we have more technology today and more possibilities to actually improve the place for more people than ever before. I mean, Germany needs a million Syrians because they're all getting old. People my age are not having children. They didn't have them. Today in Germany, in the first two grades, you have more foreign-born-based children than German-born-based children.
Wow, I didn't know that.
This means that by the time I'm 80, or my friends who went to school with me at age 80, there's nobody there to service them. So Mrs. Merkel, part of why she opened the doors is because she is facing a demographic disaster. Korea has the same problem. Japan has the same problem. In Korea, they now have, I think, 17% foreigners. But they're very clear about it. You come to Korea, you learn Korean, you act Korean, which is actually correct. I was always stunned in America that I could move to New York State and they offered that I could take my driver's license in German. I thought it was ridiculous. If you come to America, you learn English because we made a deal. English is our language. So nothing against Hispanics. I have many, many Hispanic friends. But in my opinion, you come to America, you learn English. That's what unites the country. And the fact that we are of many backgrounds is what makes our country stronger. But we need a uniting force. But instead...
And you need the immigration.
I think we need... Well, I don't know if we need the immigration in the United States, but the immigration is potentially a serious booster for the country because, by definition, the people that leave their homes that want to go to a better world are the more motivated, and a lot of times they bring with them innovation and knowledge, etc. But you also need to filter it that way. America is the only country, and in this it's beautiful. It's so democratic. I mean, I had to wait 8 years to get my permission to work here. And, you know, you don't differentiate between highly educated and smart and not. It's very democratic. It's kind of cute. I mean, I always looked at it, laughing at it, saying, well, you know, you can't have it both ways. The country is treating people equal, so here we go. Gotta wait. Gotta wait your turn. I mean, in a way, that's a beautiful thing. But now we have, you know, people, I mean, racism is just a terrible thing. It's discriminating against people or speaking against people based on just because they don't think everything the same way as you is just the wrong way to go. And it doesn't solve the problem. To me, the problem is simply the corporations have gotten too big, and they are themselves a success story, but the success story has run its course. We need to go back to having more middle class, more smaller companies, etc. And this government needs to steer this. And in this country, the government is now so on the hook by these big companies that it's not steering it. And I believe that in Britain, what you have is the people are a little bit more aware politically, and they're reacting to this. So Brexit,
and they're reacting. The Brexit results of the Leave referendum are, if I understand you right, it's a reaction to an unresponsive, overly bureaucratic, domineering corporate EU, which isn't really there to serve the best interests of the middle class in England.
Yeah, EU and even British government, but mainly EU government, which is essentially there to keep the status quo, and the status quo long term is against the British. It's against everybody. It's against the mass of people.
Yeah. And it's great if you're an oligarch and you're a member of a very small elite, but
And eventually your company and my company is going to merge and it'll be even fewer companies. But this doesn't work. So this was essentially a revolution against it. I mean, Britain is full of people who are innovative and skilled and able, and they can't find a way to take their task, their skill, and sell it, because some big people have basically taken that real estate, and they have the mechanisms in place to maintain that real estate. And
the government among those mechanisms,
whether it's large companies.
And this is happening. You and I have talked before. This is not just a British thing. It's not just America. This is happening all over the world.
It's all over the world.
I remember you telling me stories about the Ukraine and
it's all over the world. I mean, China was the big exception in China, and it happens in China too. Believe me. But in China, you come with such a low labor rate initially and then almost unlimited money if you were properly connected by the government, because the money, you know, a Chinese government lends yuan to the local economy, but they decide who gets dollars so they can go buy that really high quality machine in Germany. So it's really the Chinese government essentially sold cheap Chinese labor for exchange currency, and then with that currency decided what to buy with it, and they basically invested it in factories. So today, the most modern factories in the world are in China. They're not here. And it's really ironic because they bought a lot of our machines. I mean, look at the construction machine sector, Case and Caterpillar, and these were success stories. Now they're really sucking, not doing very well because the oil is down, etc. Well, part of it is that everybody got one now. And from now on, trust me, the next set of Caterpillars is going to be made in China. And some of the stuff is going to be made with equipment that they bought from us. They have the best equipment. The most modern factories I've been in have been in China and Germany. Germany has good factories.
You mentioned racism. Let me ask you about the nativist vote in the Leave campaign, because that's really arguably what put them over the top. Yes, there was dissatisfaction about the economy and everything you're talking about in England, but they also, you know, Johnson and those guys, they tapped into the xenophobia and the nativism and the racism that is widespread in England, and that vote put them over the top.
It's now in Germany too, which I'm extremely ashamed of. I mean, I was born into a Germany that was so ashamed of its past that we really didn't have racism. It just didn't exist. The first time I saw racism is when I showed up in New York in 1975. We didn't have it. We really learned our lesson. And even today in Germany, I think that you have nationalist parties that are getting into the double digits. Austria, they almost took the government. And it's really sad. And I believe that people are very misguided when they say, we don't want the foreigners to take the jobs, because there's so much we need to do. There's so much growth we could have. There's so many people. Every one of us wants some more stuff or some more things or some more services. So it's not that there's no labor. It's there's no management of the work. So having more people in a country, especially a country that's essentially dying in demographics, is not a problem. It's a management issue. So the people need to come, you need to assimilate them, you need to put them to the proper use and do that. But corporations don't want to put people to proper use. They want to eventually eliminate people. From a corporation's point of view, you want less people. Take General Motors, produces 10 million cars a year. That's maybe, you know, 1/7 of the car production on the planet. They do it with 200,000 people. Then they estimate that for every one job at General Motors, there's 10 more. So it's 2 million people. But now think about the value of a car. A car is one of the most expensive things we buy. So it may represent a real share of our earnings. Let's say it represents 20% of what we make. Well, 2 million people don't represent 20% of the world labor pool. So these factories are essentially eliminating jobs. So we want jobs. We all need jobs. If we don't have jobs, we end up with endless unemployed people, terrorism, and everything else. So in Switzerland, they were trying to vote to actually give free money to people because nobody could think of what to put them to work. But we need jobs. So we need to service each other. And the only way we're going to do that is by creating a platform within which many, many people can have small companies that can be successful. Now, small companies, banks don't lend money to small companies anymore. They got away from that. They learned they don't need to do that because it's a lot of work to lend money to small companies. You have to really think to do it. When you make a loan to a big company, you don't have to think. You look at the track record and you can explain it to your boss and you're done. You sign a paper and you're done. So we really need to go back to doing more work. And this is what Brexit is about. They're tired of being part of Europe because everything has gotten so big it doesn't work. So they want to go back to being smaller.
And that is the larger story. And Glenn Greenwald, I can't recommend this strongly enough, folks. Glenn Greenwald's, you can see it at The Intercept online, and his most recent commentary about the meaning of Brexit that and has everything to, as you say, it has everything to do with Trump. It has everything to do with Sanders. This is a much bigger story about what the elite oligarchs in the world, not just in America, what the elite oligarchs of the world economy are doing in relationship to the failure of Western institutions, and that this big story is really about the fate of the West. This, the, you know, that that crawled up out of the mud of the Middle Ages and redefined itself based on certain institutions that would protect human and civil rights, and they're failing. These Western institutions are failing because they have fallen prey to the very corruption that, heck, that Plato wrote about. I mean, you know, we could go all the way back, but that they've gotten too big, too bureaucratic, and too corrupt, and that they're just, as you say, they're so heavily invested in a status quo that they reject not just the idea, not just innovative products and innovative systems, they reject the very idea of innovation because it's a threat.
That's right. The other thing that's a real game changer that's becoming obvious, and, you know, we all were talking about how the internet is democratizing information and it's becoming, you know, the Arab Spring comes out of, you know, you can't control people anymore because now there's free flow of information. Well, that was true 10 years ago, but it's not true anymore. People in power are figuring out how to control the information. So it's just a question of time until the internet actually becomes a tool for the status quo maintenance. So it's a very dangerous time today. If we don't break away from these small groups controlling, we will probably end up in a disaster. And I don't think we're there, but and in America in particular, we are quite a ways away from it. But it's the beauty of America was a big middle class, and we really need to at all costs get back there. So yeah, if you live in that gated community, think about it twice. It's, you know, or if you talk against social services or this or that, we have to come up with ways to spend money to keep everybody busy.
Well, and if you look at the history of America in the 40s and 50s and 60s, you see the direct role that local, state, and federal governments had in creating the middle class. It was engineered. It was created specifically. It didn't just happen magically. There were certain programs coming out of FDR and the 50s that created a middle class, a strong middle class, because the elites recognized, you know, in the face of the Great Depression, in the face of fanaticism that was going on in Europe in World War II, they recognized the long-term secure power for a society that a middle class offered.
That's right. Getting everybody to have something to do and a stake in it.
Getting everybody to the table, exactly right.
And it's actually, there's this other dragon that's coming down the pipeline now is the learning machines, which are computers that essentially learn from their own actions.
I wanted to ask you about that. When you said corporations want to get rid of their people, what about AI? What about automation? That's coming down the track so fast.
They're 5 years away from being there and seriously taking away huge numbers of jobs.
And not just blue-collar jobs, Oliver, white-collar jobs.
Listen, an attorney
can be automated.
My job as a developer can be fully automated. I cannot do it. If you put all the parameters of all the building codes in, what you want to achieve financially, what the tenant wants, what the site looks like, there isn't an architect and there isn't a developer who can do a better job than a machine that's properly programmed. And once that machine is properly programmed, it can do that job again and again and again, which means...
And it can learn from what it
does. Only developer left is the one who has the money. Actually, on that subject, you know, we listen to the government. The government says housing starts are back to where they used to be. That's, I don't want to say a word that's bad on the air, but that is absolutely fitting. Housing starts today are back where they were because people build blocks of 200 apartments. You know, if you're in Charlottesville, behind Barracks Road, you see one. Behind Stonefield Shopping Center, you see one. Behind ACAC, you see one. Every time they build a 200-block apartment, they consider that 200 housing starts. But that's a corporation. It's a company from New York that might own it, might be a hedge fund that owns it, might be a building company that comes up from Alabama that builds it. And by the time it's done, yes, our housing starts are back where they were. But the building itself is garbage. It's designed, it may be on leased land. It may be designed to last 30 years. It may be designed to be sold in 10. This is not adding to a wealth of a nation. It does not become property of humans, of middle class that ends up owning things. So statistically, we're back to the housing starts of before 2008. But in reality, we're nowhere near close. And the guys who do development like me, half of them are out. They've basically said, you know what, I take my money, I'm done. Some are still doing it. I don't know a single person who has anything good to say about the way it's rolling now. Right now, we make money, but it's not a healthy system. So housing starts are not back where they were. The number is back, but the structure of how it is the same thing that I'm telling you here. And like you go to Britain, most people don't own their homes. In Europe and in Germany, most people spend half their income for rent. We're going in the same direction. Imagine if you had to spend half of your net income on rent, what your life looks like.
I don't have to imagine that. Welcome to my life. Okay, I live in Charlottesville. It's crazy.
It's a life that gets harder and harder.
Yeah.
And
yep.
This is not necessary, but we create this, you know, the endless regulations are there. They protect the big guys. All these things exist. So now you start having the artificial intelligence on top of it, then you really get to the brave new world where the money controls everything. Everything else is replaceable. So we have to be very, very careful.
Yeah. It's a really, the more you learn about this stuff, and the more I talk to people like you and to my friends, journalists in the last hour, Gould and Fitzgerald, it really is a frightening time. It's a frightening time. It's also a time of great opportunity, but if elites and the oligarchs have such a lock on the economy and the government and our elections, where does change happen? Where can positive change happen?
You know, if you think about the old Soviet system, which did collapse, in the end, it was that. It was just at a lower denominator. You had essentially corporations that were endorsed by the government that controlled everything. And you had no opportunity. Now, when we listened to our own propaganda, the people were miserable there, et cetera. But they actually had a life. But it wasn't a very high-level life, wasn't as high as ours. The real problem was that these corporations didn't innovate, they didn't upfit, and a few people scammed all the money at all times, and they lived well. So this blew up. And in a way, we have the same thing now, except at a higher level of living. You know, I mean... Another way to describe it is if you think about the Great Depression, you see these terrible pictures and people living in really terrible conditions. Well, part of that is because housing simply didn't exist. So when you're poor, you lived in the worst of conditions. When we had our crisis here, our financial crisis here, a lot of people did get hit, but the housing already existed. So you may have no money, but you lived in a housing with more dignity than in the 20s.
Yes, you might not have furniture in your dining room, but at least you had a roof over your head.
But you might have still lived with the same stress, with the same less than perfect situation, which people in America do have that. These people do exist in sizable numbers. We don't have 5% unemployment here. You know, I don't know what the number is, but it's 15%, 20%. I mean, I have people asking me for jobs all the time, and I just can't give them the jobs. I don't have them.
So what is Germany's role, your native state? What is Germany's role after the Brexit referendum? How do you think this is going to play out? Because we keep hearing all the key players are honest and saying, we have no idea what's going to happen. Because the Leave campaigners, they didn't have a plan. They just wanted to. It's like the people who vote for Trump. They don't know exactly what's going to happen, but they want to throw a wrench in the works because they know they don't want the status quo. Hillary Clinton's the Wall Street candidate from the left.
Well, the Leave guys, I actually think that they may be better off in some ways. But the danger is that the hate that comes there. You know, we say there are negative repercussions mainly because it messes with the system. Of course, it's going to affect the stock market. It's going to affect large corporations. Now they have to adjust. It affects certain politicians. I mean, David Cameron already resigned. So for these people, this Brexit is terrible. Actually, Brexit might not be all terrible for all British people, but there's work to be done. And you know what? That's actually the key to everything. If you do work, something comes. Maybe you go the wrong direction for a little while, and then you correct the direction, but you're actually going somewhere. The truth is, in our society today, we have made, like, zero progress. I mean, take Volkswagen, okay? Volkswagen's great innovation is LED headlights in the last decade. But we all know they cheated on emissions.
Right.
You know, these are people that are perfectly capable of creating much better cars. I mean, they can do much better than what my little group did. But they don't want to. They just want to become the largest car corporation in the world. And now they're going to end up spending $20 billion paying fines. And, you know, I don't even know if they're going to get away with just that. But this is an attitude. And within that attitude, you're going nowhere. And this is the sad thing. Where we sit here today, the innovations that we do have at our fingertips, we could truly improve our society for ourselves as well as for the whole developing world by such a leap, but we don't, because those who are running, who have their finger at the switch, simply don't know what to do when it changes. When it changes, they lose. Kodak comes up with digital photography. Oh, my God, let's not touch it too much. Let's not touch it too much. It's going to mess up our film business. And what happens? They go bankrupt. And today they sell paper. So these are the people that should have taken photography to the next level, but they never invented how they fit in when there is no paper, when there is no film. But they were the guys that knew about it before anybody else. And understood it better than anyone else, and had money, and were in that business.
So what do you say to someone who says, well, you know, Oliver, I see your point, but we still had personal computers. The innovation will happen as much as corporate America and the oligarchs and the elites don't want it to. It still finds its way.
Actually, it's not true. Innovation happens in very narrow parts. Most businesses today, in my opinion, are basically in the race to the bottom. They've learned to squeeze margins, and they somehow make money by coming up with deals, whether it's mergers or refinancing this or doing that. But these are not real value-added things.
They're not innovating products and services.
Yeah. Yeah. Real value-added is if a company that makes washing machines figures out how to make washing machines much cheaper and figures out how to sell them to another billion people who want washing machines. And by the way, figures out how to get water to them too, because they don't have any water.
Yeah.
You know? But that's how we used to think in the 50s, 60s, 70s. Today, we value engineer companies, and this worked for 20 years. For 20 years, people could write themselves nice checks. You could make a case for what you're going to do with a company, which means you eliminated risk, and you looked like a hero. But this is running out now, which is part of why stock market isn't going to go anywhere. I wouldn't put any money in the stock market. I just don't see, you know, serious value, further growth in that direction. So the old business model is kind of sputtering. The way we can break this mold is if we really figure out how to open more industries up to people again. You know, part of it is in financial sector. We simply don't lend money to a good idea today. We don't. You know, when I started, I'm 54 years old now. When I started, I could actually go and get a loan with a good idea. If I wrote up a case, you know, my loan officer, who was just a vice president loan officer, could give me up to $50,000, which was a lot more money in 1984 than today, on his discretion. Today, the city manager's limit is $50,000. It's not working. And the other thing that happened is 30 years ago, there might be a neighbor who might lend me some money. Today, there's no neighbor who has money because he has it in a TIA CREF account or some other account. So we no longer lend each other money either. I bought several of my buildings by being owner-financed. Today, most people wouldn't do that because they have a professional managing their money. Well, the professional did a good job managing their money while people extracted value from old companies. But that train has finished. So we really need to get back to where money becomes available to smaller ideas and smaller people.
And how do you do that, though?
I don't know everything.
And that's the question I get all the time is, well, what are we supposed to do? No matter who we vote for, then nothing changes.
The Brexit guys basically said, you know what, let's just separate from the really big group and let's become a smaller group again. And that's probably not a bad place to start as a thought. Yes, there are efficiencies by putting it all together, but the efficiencies have run their course, and now the efficiencies have become so successful that they are self-protecting, and they're essentially not allowing us to move further. So I think that's part of what Brexit is about.
So what about the EU after England leaves? And we can assume they will. There's still some talk about negating what was a recommendation that was a non-binding referendum. If Parliament wants millions of people protesting in the streets and blood in the streets, they will vote to stay in. But what about the EU after Brexit? What about places like Spain and Greece?
Those are really the problem. But you know, the real problem with the EU is the fact that the currencies have been taken away from the countries, because that's balance of trade is what kills countries. And balance of trade, you can rectify by sneakily introducing inflation. Inflation is a great tool. I mean, the Italians ended up with liras that were worth nothing. 2,000 liras was like $3. But they basically used this tool of inflation to basically rectify all their sins. And everybody knew it. So they all played with it. And the Greeks need inflation, but the euro doesn't allow inflation. So now the Germans are telling the Greeks how many euros they get to print, and they have no tool to get out of this. So the way they're trying to get them out is by squeezing their salaries. It doesn't work.
Austerity, yeah.
Yeah, it doesn't work. So it works in Germany because that's how Germans think. It doesn't work in Greece. Greece has never worked like that, neither has Spain. I mean, it's actually surprising how well Spain has done doing austerity. I mean, it's shocking, actually. But ultimately, I believe the euro is the part that's actually sort of doomed, or the euro simply needs to become a smaller currency. But I mean, you look at the really productive countries in Europe, Poland, Czech Republic, they have their own currencies. Some of the Scandinavians,
they're not part
of the EU. Semi-in. No, Poland is in the EU, Czech Republic is in the EU, but they have their own currencies. So there's the EU, there's the Eurozone, and then there's the Schengen visa zone. Those are all different things.
Okay.
So If you allow your country to print your own money, then you can actually negotiate some what happens. The fact that the pound just dropped is actually really good for British business. It's bad if I'm trying to buy an iPad because I have to pay in dollars, and now my pound buys fewer dollars. So I'm having a bad day because my iPad just went up $60 in price. But for my business, if I'm the guy that makes, you know, lamps, my lamps just went down 10% to the export market.
Made them more affordable. More competitive,
so,
yeah.
So the pound going down was actually good for my business, as long as they don't offset it by adding a 10% tax to everything coming from Britain to Germany.
Which they could.
Which they will. It's a negotiation.
Yeah.
They will. But it goes both ways. So now my lamp has a tax, but the lamp from Germany also has a tax, so I end up selling more lamps in my country. That's what really ends up happening. So is that good? There need to be some tools that balance things because we're not all equal. The Greeks don't want to work as much. They want to stay up until 2 in the morning. And they don't need to heat their homes at night. And they have different priorities. But they still live. They still feed themselves. They still enjoy life. When you force them to live like Germans, they start to not be quite as happy. And the same the other way around.
That's what austerity is doing.
That's what's kind of trying to happen there. Yeah. They're trying to basically create one set of rules for all. So the currency needs to go, and I expect the currency is going to go. So I wouldn't be surprised if the euro sticks around, but it's going to be a smaller circle of countries. You know, maybe Germany, France, and the Netherlands and a few other countries. But I don't think it's going to be as many countries as it is today. It's simply a tool that restricts the local governments too much. It just doesn't allow them. That's the biggest tool they have to equalize for their sins.
And it discourages, as you say, because of the very nature of the big centralized bureaucratic engine, it discourages innovation in the same way that a corporation does.
That's right. But if you're into power and you end up being part of the machine that sits in Brussels, you don't want to lose more power. It's not what you want to do. So the truth is Europe's probably better off with having countries that have their own currency, at least some of them, or a good chunk of them, or maybe two different.
What do you make of the conversation in Scotland to have another referendum for independence? Because over 60, 70% of Scotland voted to stay in the EU.
I don't know enough about it, but clearly, this is the sad part. You know, I'm not against the whole Brexit thing, but the Brexit thing, this is all a path toward trouble. So I'm very ashamed that in Germany we have a party that's now very nationalistic. In Czech Republic they have it. In Austria they have it to a tremendous amount. The French have it. This is all the stuff. This is now disturbances that is creating a situation that's less than perfect. But I really believe it comes out of that people are frustrated. They don't know where to go, and they don't really know what to blame. And I believe what is to blame is that simply too many organizations have taken too many parts of the economy and have become complacent with it. And as a result, you have some haves and mostly have-nots, and it's just not an acceptable.
And a rapidly increasing number of have-nots.
And nowhere to go. Like, yeah. If the have-nots have a little bit more in 5 years and a little bit more in 10 years, then it's one way to go. But it's going the other direction. They're going into debt. I mean, in Italy, you know, people never had debt. You know, when I grew up as a kid, nobody had a car loan. You saved your money and then you bought a car. And when it was worn out, you had already saved some money and you bought another car. Now it's the other way around. Now in Italy, from what I understand, there's such a housing debt that there's nowhere to go. So you can see when you start with no debt and you run for a generation and you create enough debt that everybody's in debt, you actually have a very prosperous generation. Because during this period of 20 years, when you go from no debt to lots of debt, you create a lot of money. You pump a lot of money into the economy, consumption, vacations, new cars, whatever. But now you've reached the point where everybody has their home leveraged from no leverage, and you give it to your child.
It's not a long-term strategy.
It's not a long-term strategy. It gives you a generation of wealth, just like what we did with the corporations. We have corporations that are worth something. We split them up. We spin them off. We merge them. We liquidate them. And we look very, very smart on the stock market, and our investors make a lot of money. You can do that for 20 years, but by the time you're done, you basically created a company that can't make it through the next hiccup because it has killed all of its reserves. And this is what we've done. And now we're there. So, you know, a lot of Europe is in debt now, which it didn't used to be. In my opinion, a lot of the corporations have gone their road. And, you know, I know a few private corporations that are very, very successful. And one of the things they all have in common is they reinvest like crazy in R&D.
Innovation.
Yeah. But, you know, our Senator Mark Warner the other day, he said it used to be 50% got back into plant and equipment or R&D, and now it's 5%. The rest goes into stockholder value, bonuses, buybacks for stocks and stuff like that. I mean, can't they think of something better than buying their own stock back? I mean, come on. If you're in business, come on. You can improve your business.
It's interesting. We see the same thing in the arts. If you look at what Hollywood cranks out, the remakes and there's a new Ghostbusters movie with women instead of men. It's a perfect example of what you're talking about in the arts. It's not innovation. We're not going to change it. We're going to change it around the edges to give you the theater of change, but it's really not change.
And part of it is because we've decided that we would take zero risk, and you don't go anywhere with zero risk. You have to lose a few. Be prepared to lose a few to make a lot. That's how we got where we are, and that's where we need to go. That's what we need to do.
Yeah. We're talking with Oliver Kuettner, Charlottesville developer and entrepreneur. Let's take a very quick break. There's more when we get back. You're listening to 94.7 WPVC. Let's continue our conversation with Charlottesville developer, entrepreneur, winner of the Automotive XPRIZE, Oliver Kuttner. Oliver is live in studio. Let me ask you a question. Take what we've been talking about over the last most of the last hour, which is a real macro view of the world economy and politics and the fate of the West, and sort of put that in the context of what you do on a micro level day to day in development, fixing up old buildings, looking for tenants, your vision of a number of properties in downtown Charlottesville. How do you see this playing out in Charlottesville with the development that you do and you've done for so many years here? A lot of people are unhappy, Oliver. An increasing number of people who live here are unhappy with the development. Not only the pace, but what we're seeing. Yeah. The kind of stuff we're seeing, like on West Main Street with these towering student high-rises.
I don't think a lot of people are unhappy with what I do, but I don't do that much.
And let me just pause there and agree with you. I'm a huge fan of the work that you do. It's beautiful. It's original. It's different. It's not cookie cutter. And unlike most developers in town, you're out there on the site every day actually doing it.
Yeah, but the problem is this. And this is actually a real problem. We want to have everything. So we create layers and layers and layers of what needs to be done. And by doing that, we create an environment where those with money can do the development and the others can't. Like, if I think of myself, how I got into development, I had no intention of ever even owning a building. One guy offered to finance the building, so I bought it. And then it was in City Hall that I had such a pleasant exchange with Ron Higgins, who was second in command in the building inspections department. And Mr. Hooja, I got along with him. These people encouraged me to do things, and they were easy to work with. My first plans, I drew them myself. It took me an hour at home, and I would get permits with this. Today, you can't get a permit unless you have XYZ license, etc. So one of the things that we've created is we've created an environment where an Oliver Kuttner-like person cannot start today. Like, when I was in my mid-20s, I started to do some development on the side, kind of as a sideline, and I grew into it, and I thought it was a pretty good business, pretty fun, and I got better and better at it. And now, some of the paperwork is so miserable. Now, let me be clear, though. It's not the fault of the people who work in these offices. It's simply the sheer quantity of obstacles. So if you are trying to get a permit to do something, and you have to do 25 things. I mean, if you remember when I was trying to get the micro apartments, I went back four times to the city. I spent $80,000 and I ended up not getting my special use permit to build micro apartments. That's insanity. But the real problem is that a person without a lot of money can't even get to the table. So now the people that are at the table are people with money who might do five projects. They might give a few hours each and then hire people to do it. So when you hire people to do it, they don't want to have risks. So you end up building cookie-cutter things. You build up square floors. You build up buildings with as little as possible. And it's all about money. So no wonder you get stuff you don't like. You get stuff you don't like because you've eliminated the system where the person who actually loves the building can actually work. So this is where we are. And I believe it's also dangerous because we've kind of taken away the mechanism whereby someone could become me. I'm 54 years old today. I don't know what I own in buildings. I probably own, I don't know, 10, 15 buildings. And, you know, I got there by buying a building and a building and a building and then selling a building and then buying. And, you know, I don't see a mechanism where today, between the way the banks work, the way the city hall permitting process works, et cetera, where a person can get to that point by the time they're
54. Unless you're born into money or a trust fund,
into
baby,
money, yeah, fine. Yeah. If you're born into money, fine.
You'll get there.
But if you're born into money, this is the problem with Brexit.
Exactly.
So,
yeah. That's
so the money keeps the money, and the projects that people criticize are from the people who have the money.
Who are low risk. They do cookie cutter stuff.
Right.
Yeah. It's some investment group from New
York
building in places like Charlottesville who don't know the community, and they could care less about the community because they're just looking at the numbers.
So when you create the endless obstacles, you also eliminate the small player. And the small player is the foundation of our healthy society. So have to be careful what we're doing there.
Yeah. And long term, we concluded before with the macro discussion, long term, that's scary.
Yes.
It's scary.
Well, you eliminate a skill set. I mean, today I'm better at it. I've never said that I'm good at it, but I'm better at it now than I was 20 years ago.
Yeah.
But
it makes you wonder, like, where the, you know, Gabe, bless his soul, he's passed away, but where are the Gabes and the Olivers?
Well, Gabe is the one who got me into it.
Yeah, yeah.
Gabe is the one who kept encouraging me, telling me I should do it. So then I said, okay, I'll just do it. Because I could do it on the side.
Yeah.
Because it wasn't very taxing.
Where are the next Gabes? Gabe Silvermans, who's passed away, great Charlottesville developer. And
today you can't do it.
Where are those guys
side?
In their 20s, you know?
Today you have to do it full time. And before you even own the property, before you even know if you have a permission to build something, you spend $100,000. That's insane. So what am I doing? The truth is, what I'm doing is I'm actually selling a fair amount of stuff. I'm going to keep some things, but my intention is to spend more time in Europe because my children are in Europe.
Right, right.
And my other intention is to really spend the rest of my strength to make the car into a game changer. I still work on it every day. I believe in it fiercely. And I think that with more persistence, I will succeed, because I'm actually figuring out how to build factories that are not super capital intensive now.
Yeah. Well, I was going to say, when it comes to the XPRIZE and the VLC, the very light car that you and your team designed and built, you certainly experienced firsthand corporations that are opposed to innovation. In meeting after meeting after meeting, am I right?
Yeah. What I'm working on now, if I succeed with it, it's every large corporation's worst nightmare. So my intention is that I could build a car here in the room here with a few guys. I could build the chassis in a couple of hours, no major tooling, and I can do. And the chassis that I build is safer than anything that's out there. Where we are now is I have a chassis that weighs under 100 pounds for a four-seat car. It's made out of aluminum and costs less than $1,000. And I believe it can scale up in serious production in small factories. Imagine 20,000 square foot warehouse with a large parking lot outside.
And Oliver, that would revolutionize the world, which is why the GMs of the world...
Which is what I want to do.
Would have every... it's like the death of the electric car. You know, they have every invested interest in destroying your effort.
And nobody's trying to destroy it. What's very interesting is in every company, whether it's GM or Chrysler, every company where I had good friends, there were always a number of them that said, you're right, this is what has to happen. And you know, there's a company called Honda. Honda believes to its core what I say is the worst nightmare and the answer. They're also working on it. So that is something that's coming. And then the other big game changer are those driverless cars.
Which are here.
Will not be owned. They will be owned by, again, large corporations, whether it's the Uber. I mean, Uber wants to get rid of its drivers, something fierce.
Yeah.
Okay. If Uber can figure out how to borrow money in the capital markets and essentially own a fleet of 300,000
cars. And Oliver, this technology exists. The technology exists for you to go on your phone and punch up a driverless car to show up in front of your house.
Not quite yet. Where you are today is, to build a driverless car today is about $70,000. And that's still a bit of a capital hurdle, but it will be $1,500 by 2020.
The technology exists, is what I said. The economics might not work yet.
When that driver gets replaced with a one-time $1,500 investment in a car that's then run by a major computer, then that driver is gone. And those drivers are going to be gone in America. So if your job is driver, if it's just driver, your job is on a short leash.
In our lifetime.
No.
Right?
In this decade.
Oh, my God. Is it happening that
fast? It's going to scale so fast. It's going to 2020, you'll see it roll out. 2025, you'll see it everywhere.
Wow. And the
economic saving is insane. Like, you cannot imagine. Like, even when you like a car, you're going to keep that car you have, but you're not going to buy another one, which is why this is also the car company's worst nightmare. Because when a car today is parked 96% of the time.
Yeah.
When a car is driverless and it's run by a computer, it's always operating.
You don't need to buy one. You just need to punch up one on your phone.
You pay
so
for
you
the
can
use.
Get home from the grocery store. Yeah.
You pay for the use. The car is tailored to the use. It becomes a very catered to giving you something to do with your time. and it'll be owned by the Googles of the world. And your cost per mile goes down to a pathetically low amount of money. So that money that you spend every month on your car simply becomes much smaller. And that's going to be enough incentive for most people. And then the other thing what's going to happen is the last mile issue gets resolved. So we have a little company called Relay Foods in Charlottesville, which is a cool company. A company like that can start using those driverless cars when they're not busy. Most driverless cars will be very, very busy during certain hours.
Right.
But let's say from 9:30 until 11:30, they're not very busy. They might be distributing food. So what do you think happens to the grocery store that's right next to us here with a large parking lot that they have to pay for? The grocery store is already in the race to the bottom. They're already working on almost no margin. So a number of the grocery companies, you start to take away 2-3% from them, they're done. So you really are facing a situation where, in my opinion, all this Route 29 development, I wouldn't touch it with a 10-foot pole personally. I wouldn't own a piece of real estate out here. You couldn't get me to buy it. I think downtown Charlottesville is good because it's interesting, and we humans have to live and enjoy life.
Yeah.
But out here, I think it's going to get displaced by the last mile problem being solved with the driverless cars, for the most part. You know,
because you won't have to go to the grocery store. You'll go on your phone, you'll punch up your groceries, and a driverless car will pull it up to your house.
The grocery comes to you, the Chipotle comes to you, Bed Bath & Beyond comes to you. All these things come to you. And remember, even if they only take 20% of the business, 20% is enough to disrupt this system, this equilibrium enough that these companies are going to fail one after the other. They can't sustain a 20% hit. You start to take 20% of the retail out of Route 29, what do you think happens to the value of Route 29 real estate?
Yeah. And so, this is happening now. This is coming.
This is lining up now. Real estate cycles are long. This is lining up now. To me, the only thing worth anything is where you live, because people need to live somewhere, maybe even a little bit better, services. Downtown Mall Charlottesville has a serious reason of existence. It's cool, it's interesting, and it's already has the people count and the interesting businesses. In my opinion, the rest of it is in for a very rocky road.
Oliver Kuttner is a developer here in Charlottesville, winner of the Automotive X Prize. This conversation will be podcast online at InsideSeville.com. Oliver, thank you, my friend. Thank you for being here.
Thank you. Have a nice day.
Enjoyed it. You've been listening to Inside Charlottesville on 94.7 WPVC. I'm Coy Barefoot. You can find me online at CoyBarefoot.com and hit me up on Facebook as well. Y'all have a great week and be good to each other. We'll be back here next Monday at 4 o'clock.